Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is part 2 of episode 27, where we're discussing Andrew Pettigrew's Journal of Management Studies classic on context and action in the transformation of the firm. This is one of the rare episodes for which we have a full-length recording available. So if for some reason you decided to listen starting with part 2, and you haven't listened to part 1 yet, you can listen to the whole thing without interruption by going to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com and following through to the episode page. Please remember that we also now have a newsletter that comes out every Wednesday, and if you'd like to follow the podcast news, find out more about events, as well as some unique and nowhere else seen content, please subscribe to that also by going to the website and scrolling down. You only need an email to do that. Alright, hope you enjoy the rest of the conversation with Andrew Pettigrew, and if you haven't listened to part 1 yet, please go and do so now or listen to the whole thing on the website. Now back to the conversation.
Yes. No. Well, that's a very good example. And it illustrates many things. Of course, the huge potential of resistance to change in bureaucracies and the problem of challenging idea systems which are becoming dominant. And I think this, again, switching back to the ICI study, as well as the general observation that change didn't come incrementally but was highly episodic, there were periods of high levels of change and periods of incremental adjustment followed by another high level era. These inflection points were often associated with changes in power at the top of the organization, with challenging of ideas of those people in power at that time. And so the challenging of ideas and the alterations in the power system were also enabled by changes in the outer context, the fact that companies who are going through hard time become more susceptible to people with new ideas who get into new positions of power. So the relationship between outer contextual change and changes in the political system and the cultural system linked to challenging and changing of the belief systems are all part of the mosaic of politics which triggers change in certain eras. And I would have thought the military would have been even more difficult to change in these respects than an elite institution like ICI was for much of its era. And of course the power systems in the military are much more firmly based on positional power, I guess, than you might expect in other organizations where other forms of power associated with credibility and with reputation and with expertise may also be important. In other words, I think the politics of change in the military, I would expect to be somewhat different from the politics of change you would find in a chemical company like ICI or in any other private sector firm. I wonder whether you, Tom, whether you've got any views about that.
I do. I think military organizations, at least, you know, American military organizations are generally pretty good when it comes to internal innovation. There's a strong desire to do things better. There's a lot of freedom given to subordinate leaders to exercise innovative change, you know, small scale. The big challenge comes into the bureaucratic system when it's especially at, you know, when you were talking about transformational change, because when you're talking about transformational change, this is more than what the military can do on its own. It depends very much, you know, just like any public sector, it depends very much on the relationship between the military and, in our case, Congress, who provides the funding. And so you have a whole bureaucratic process that's oriented around planning the future of the military, programming or coming up with programs that determine what the capabilities are that the military requires or must sustain, and then budgeting it. And there's a definite time lag. And what you want to talk about, you know, how history comes into play. And we think about a transformation effort, like if you have a large-scale transformation effort, it would take decades from the time in which the decision is made to start the change. That is, we need this particular capability, we're going to reorganize or what have you. You know, decades from that point to when some of these capabilities actually start being fielded. And, of course, that's two decades of time in which significant other activities, change activities, are either going along with it or conflicting with it or what have you. And so the when it comes, by the time, you know, the first decade is rolled around, sometimes you're looking at this change and saying, what were we thinking in the first place? And if you lose that sense of history, then the change effort is probably in trouble.
I do have the word transformation, of course, in the title of that 1987 article. But I think the issue of culture, national culture, is an important issue to reflect on in terms of the language people use to address change. I think the Brits are somewhat skeptical, cynical about transformational leaders in the same way as the Australians are. I mean, the Australians, so I was told, don't like the notion of tall poppies, and they like to remove the heads of tall poppies. Now, so I think this may be one thing different between the Australian and UK cultures and the American culture, where I think there's a greater willingness to accept the notion of transformational leaders. And that phrase actually hasn't taken on the potency in the UK in anywhere near the same way it has in the writing on management and leadership in the US. So I think leadership and change are culturally laden terms. I suppose this is what I'm trying to say. And I wonder whether you both have a view on that.
I think certainly that different cultures treat their leaders and leadership differently, but I don't know, maybe it is about messaging more so than what's actually done. Andrew, I don't know, do you have a view on what is the leader's role in understanding external context and internal context and the relationship between the two? What can leaders do to manage that relationship and to steer the firm in a particular way, or is this not a realistic possibility?
Well, I think it's essential that somebody in the firm does this, and ideally sets of people and not an individual. I think if organizational learning becomes just the learning of the chief executive or the top executives, it'll be a very limited form of learning for the corporation. It'll essentially be contained at the top, and that's no good. So organizational learning has to become a much broader based activity than that. And that means encouraging, of course, a culture of learning way beyond the top and the principal functionaries of the organization. So organizational learning is a very important factor in all this, and the rate of learning is crucial, and especially related to the speed of change, of course, and the environment. And we know many companies which have not adjusted it to the rate of change that's gone on in their environments, and their leaders have been guilty people often in those processes.
I was a bit surprised that you talked as much about the role of transformational leaders and specific individuals at the top of the organization, because this work seems to emphasize, as the title says, context and action, neither one of which is explicitly connected to a particular individual. And it seemed to me that one of the key contributions that you are making is that the one person at the top or a small group of people at the top actually have a very negligible effect as a concept of leadership, and it's more to do with what different patterns of activities accomplish in specific contextual circumstances.
Yeah, right. I mean, the whole thesis is it's context plus action, never action on its own. And I think, but at the same time, I mean, one can be cynical about the potential of leaders to influence events. But remember my own personal philosophy. Everything is possible in life until proven otherwise. I have seen individuals making a huge impact on the context in which they're leading and managing. And in fact, I won't mention his name, but one of the leaders of Warwick Business School in the time I was there is certainly been the most effective university leader I've ever encountered in my life. And this is, and I've seen other people having an impact, but never on their own. It's always in the context of building a team around them, and not just at the very top, but down into the system. And this requires what I would call contextual intelligence, both about the inner context of the organization that they're trying to lead, and about the point you're making about the significance of the external context. So contextual intelligence is not being discussed very much in the literature. There's been a lot of discussion about the emotional intelligence of leaders, but not contextual intelligence. And you can see people all the time stumbling over their failure to understand or intervene effectively in both the inner context they're trying to lead and manage and the external context. And I'm sure there must be examples of military history of those kinds of failures. And I suspect examples in recent political history and events in Australia, where there have been a succession of short-term prime ministers in Australia in recent times, with one or two notorious examples of leaders being stabbed in the back by their immediate compatriots. So these things are important, and I think, although I haven't defined what I mean by contextual intelligence, I'm sure it's a crucial factor in the success of leaders, either as seen as individuals or as part of teams.
And I agree with you. I think one of the things that I sometimes wonder about, and when I'm talking about organizational communication, I see this a lot. We have a culture where, and I don't think it's confined to the military, but we do have a culture that suggests that the chief executive or the top commander is expected to be looking up and out, and less so internally. I've seen that in the habits of some of the senior commanders, where the external context is almost a separate duty responsibility or a primary responsibility, to the expense of the internal context, who winds up being managed more by, say, a deputy or a chief of staff, however something's organized. So indeed, I agree with you that the both contexts are important, because if dealings with the external context are causing disruption or are paradoxical with what's needed in the internal, and there isn't somebody looking both ways, that it can be a problem.
One thing that came to mind while you were talking there is this idea of contextual intelligence is very rich, and I get the sense of it's very important to be aware of what's going on in your own party, for example, if we're talking politics, and in the external environment. But what about contextual influence? In Australia, we sometimes get the sense that individuals are overwhelmed by contexts, and they don't have the sufficient influence to steer things the way that they would like. Is there a way that leaders can be more influential over their context, both internal and external, and perhaps for business? Maybe they need to be more engaged with policy, understanding political environments, but also influencing them.
Well, I think that's crucial. And, there are many examples of leaders not having that capacity, or feeling they don't have it. You know, I think one of the biggest source of skeptics against leadership, of course, are the sociologists, who argue that the world is full of constraint and it's not possible to be leaders. They are pawns, not potentates. And this is a familiar argument in sociology. And you can see that, of course, but you can also see that two leaders faced with the same objective conditions of constraint, yet one defines themselves as a pawn, they see all the constraints. The other one defines themselves as potentially able to be a potentate. So the same objective conditions notionally exist, but one defines the situation quite differently for the other, and as a consequence is able to intervene with much greater potential than the other. So perception plays a crucial intervening factor in conditions of apparently the same constraint.
Well, taking us back to when we talked about competitive groups as cognitive communities with Sarah Kaplan and the paper by Porach, we learned that the way leaders and managers understand their external context, to put it in the terminology of today, is by ingesting a very limited, very constrained amount of information, almost this echo room type, and then making interpretations of it. And, you know, that's all well and good, but I'm wondering whether the true punching power of managers and leaders comes from being able to construct a context within organizations. So what might be a function of leadership is not this heroic leader that many of us have an issue with as an ideology, but more an ability of senior executives to surround themselves with the sources of information and the technology and the various processes and practices that build a context which then can be acted upon and within.
I think that's one of the essential processes associated with contextual intelligence. It's the ability to mobilize a context in order to create a more receptive setting for the possibilities of different forms of action. So mobilization of the context is a crucial political skill and tactical skill. And in the 80s, in the Thatcher era, this was one of the crucial facets of behavior attempted by managers. They exaggerated the extent of problems in the business and around the business in order to soften up the employees for the necessity of change. And I remember people saying to me at the time, thank God this awful woman has come along who has now opened the window for the possibility of change. All the things that we in the past had said were impossible had now been made more possible. So this Mrs. Thatcher has opened the window for change. This is a literal phrase that people used at the time in order to mobilize the context to do things they had been fearful of attempting because of the real and imagined power held by the trade unions at that time. So, yes, I think the mobilization of contact is a crucial part of the politics of delivering change. And Mrs. Thatcher, of course, was herself very skilled at doing that. And I've said that one of the crucial skills she had was to win 3 elections, but she was also very skillful at changing the conversation in British society at that time, which allowed people to make changes that they had previously imagined to be impossible. So I'm not portraying Mrs. Thatcher here as a saint, but merely talking about the real politic of political life at the societal level and at the firm level. And if you can't mobilize the context around your agenda, you're lost.
Well, even beyond that, beyond mobilization, the actual creation of context, because mobilization seems to make sense in circumstances where there is a strong or an established outer context. But what about when we're talking about some disruptive industries or technologies or just ways of doing work that are not susceptible to a particular outer context? For example, remote work, or kind of what we're doing here, that we are located all over the world, we face different outer contexts, and then there is not a context or a sense of a context that we could mobilize, so we have to create one as leaders in our teeny tiny organization. But then again, there's global corporations that operate along the same lines, that if the employees and the organization is so distributed and so flat, then there seems to be a lot of room to actually manufacture and craft a particular context within which people would then act. What do you think?
Well, can you give me an example of that?
No. Ella?
So my PhD research looked at remote working. And for example, in Australia, we have nurses who work from home all over Australia, and they don't ever see each other. They only communicate using an instant messaging system. And so that's how they seem to create a sense of context with one another. And leadership play quite a passive role in that. But there is this sense that context is actually being actively created. And if it weren't for ongoing communication and effort, there would be no context. Is that what you were referring to, Demetrios, in terms of constructing context?
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, this is Australia. What if we think about some global system? Or even a setting where there is no outward leadership, like we talked about this some time ago. Oh, right. So the emergence of algorithmic management, all the systems like that Uber and Deliveroo are using, those are specific, unprecedented types of organizing work that you don't even need to have necessarily an organization with leadership in place in order to have labor organized in this particular way. It's all done through a particular process. And that kind of manufactures a certain context that is new, that's exciting, that's doesn't have much history behind it. And of course, there's friction associated with making sense of it and making it work within a more established environment. But generally, the idea that a context can be manufactured anew using maybe a certain set of material environments or technologies or processes or attitudes, I think that's a very interesting concept for leadership and for transformational leadership in particular.
Mm. No, I agree. I mean, these are inventions, I would almost suggest, you know, new businesses, big and new business ideas that people haven't thought of before and have now thought of in the context of the technology which is now available. And this is, isn't this, aren't we talking here essentially about the entrepreneur as leader, and which is a different kind of leadership than you would expect to find in and around political institutions or in and around the bureaucracies associated with the military or the bureaucracies associated with university life? Because, I mean, we're all operating in highly routinized situations where the definition of what scholarship is has now been so confined that it's something that you have to write in 30 pages and publish in a certain kind of outlet. I mean, this is the, it seems to me, is the complete antithesis of scholarship, that we would allow ourselves to be routinized in that kind of way. And people are happily accepting this throughout the world.
Well, I don't know about happily.
Yeah, I was just going to say,
it's ludicrous that this has happened. I mean, when I was a boy academic, you know, the most important form of scholarship was written in a research monograph. You know, the ultimate form of scholarship was expressed in book form. Now it's the complete opposite of that, where people who write books are regarded as strange and weird, and their scholarship is not accepted. I mean, I've always fought that. When I've been a dean, I fought, and I still fight it, to try and create space for people to express scholarship in more than this single dimension. So the problem or the possibility of entrepreneurial leadership, which is what you were talking about there in referring to the technological examples, is equally well needed in our own culture, where there is far too much constraint, I think, being imposed upon young people. which is stifling innovation, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, what we're talking here is that we have an established context, but the content is largely unchanged from when we had monograph centers, universities, to then when we transitioned to this journal-obsessed system, certainly within business schools. But if you look at things now, there's an emergence of new ways of constructing, of placing content in different contexts, if you will. So this drive for open access journals, this drive to digitalize and index books as well, so that they also count. Then there's more emergent forms of scholars trying to put themselves out there, like what we're doing here. A number of universities throughout Europe and recently Australia are actually using our podcast in their teaching and various impact activities. I had another example, but I lost it now. But essentially, there is this drive to introduce a different context that even here.
I was going to add blogs to that, because that's actually something that that I'm exploring within our organization. There's quite a in the military sphere. They're not run by military for the most part, but there's a whole plethora of blog-based journals. I use that term loosely. It doesn't resemble an academic journal. It's essentially a commentary, like a Small Wars Journal comes to mind, War on the Rocks, a few of those, where there's essentially a move towards content that is very concise, and it's commentary driven, even further away from what we're talking about in this work here about longitudinal study and all that. It seems like focus gets even more narrow,
big
potentially.
Game changer in the academic world at the moment has been propagated by the UK state, which influences its educational policy much more than happens in the United States, where there is this huge power around the high-profile elite private universities. Here, as you probably know, the state intervened in the academic system 5 years ago by saying, hey, you lot, you're fixated by your publishing processes, and but the publishing is just an intermediate good. The final good is if anybody notices your work, either anybody in the scholarly world, or more importantly, anybody in the world of policy and practice. So the big game changer here has been the concern with impact, both scholarly impact and even more significantly, the policy and practice impact. And this, I know, is now a real issue in Australia and in New Zealand, and I think shortly will be in continental Western Europe, where governments will say, like the British government has done, universities are important parts of society which should be engaging more with society. And this, I think, will help to rejuvenate an interest in what is published, and not just with the current fixation with where it is published. So I have high hopes that the changes in the UK educational policy sphere will bring about fundamental change in the kind of research that's going on, and also where and how it is communicated, and with what effect. So I suppose this is saying again that leadership does matter, but we're talking about the leadership of the state, changing the rules of the game, and in a way which is actually going to provide greater freedom for people to express themselves in a scholarly way, so they are not just contained by the requirements of so-called A-rated journals. So I have hope for some liberation.
It's happening. It's happening. And I think for a lot of researchers, there's a challenge in learning how to translate your scholarly work for a different audience. It's quite a different language and way of communicating that you need to become accustomed with. And in terms of leadership, we at the University of Sydney Business School are getting a lot of support through, for example, a platform called Sydney Business Insights, where we're recording podcasts, blogs, videos, where we're helped in communicating our research to a different and broader audience to try and reach people who otherwise might not be reading academic journals, because, I mean, they're very hard to access a lot of the time. But it is a translation piece. And I watched, Andrew, your BBC documentary from 1991 about Peugeot, the $1 deal, which is available on YouTube. And what a wonderful way to actually see managers speaking about their experiences and their work. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how that came about and the experience of it.
Well, I think that was fortuitous. I met a TV producer at the time who suddenly was no longer working for one of the big companies. In fact, the company he worked for at that time was Granada TV. And the television companies were all forced by legislation, by government policy, to say, look, start to employ freelance producers. And many of the producers lost their jobs with the big companies. So this is another liberation story, if you like. And they were forced to go out and find new product. So this guy, he discovered I led a research center at the time, which I mentioned earlier. And he thought, hey, there's some television product here. I better go and meet this guy, Pettigrew, and find out if they're doing anything interesting which might be turned into a television production. And in fact, thanks to his efforts, we made together four television productions at that time. And I've actually got on my CV at the bottom of it, four TV programs. Which is something better than listing a series of journal articles.
where Andrew's headshot is.
What?
That's where your headshot is on the bottom of CV. Special television skills, appearances.
So, no, I'm serious that this was very educational, I'm sure, for him, but also for us. And It got our research way beyond the audiences that we normally would get to. But I think the impact issue is not just about dissemination, which is important. It's a necessary step. The impact issue, as it's been defined over here for scholars, is to say, can you change people's policies and practices as a result of your research? And that's much more than just disseminating it on a wider scale. And that's the challenge from the British government for us. And what it means to me is pressure to meet a double hurdle or a double challenge. So to produce work of the highest scholarly quality, which also has policy and practice impact. So this is the new game, and I think many academics over here are just waking up to the reality of this. But I think that's great. Keep challenging academics, challenging them about their relationship, not just with their own discipline and with their own field, but with the societies that they're part of. And universities are no longer containable within ivory towers, and we should be expected to be contributors to society. And one way we can contribute is not just through educationally what we do in the classroom or way beyond the classroom, as we're seeing here tonight, but also what we're doing to shape the policies and practices of organizations that are still important bodies, institutional bodies in our society.
I think so. And the timing is excellent. So thank you so much for joining us. It's been wonderful and an absolute pleasure to hear from you.
Thanks so much, Andrew. It's been great speaking with you.
And I also thank you. It was tremendous.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
And that's all for episode 27. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed our conversation with Andrew Pettigrew, who has been absolutely amazing, not only in joining us, but also in sharing his experience and accrued management wisdom with us and you, of course, our lovely listeners. Just another reminder that we do have a newsletter available now, so if you'd like to follow the podcast in that kind of way, you can do so by subscribing with your email only on our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, if you're enjoying this, please leave us a positive review on iTunes or wherever else you may be listening, and share the podcast with your friends, colleagues, and students. Please join us next week as we bring you a summary of episode 27 by Tom, and then on to the last three. Wow, it's amazing that the season is almost complete, but yes, we have three more episodes left, focusing on works by Mads Alvesen, Hugh Wilmot, and Herbert Simon, here on Talking About Organizations.